Welcome to the Your Courageous Life podcast, where we discuss psychology and tools to help you create better habits, cultivate discipline, and live with courage, aka grit and emotional resilience. I'm your host, Kate Swoboda. Learn more about my books and get additional resources at yourcourageouslife.com. And now, here's today's episode. Hey, hey, everybody. So today's podcast episode will be about how to get and stay motivated. And I have kind of a funny little behind the scenes that's tied to that. That is, real life. We're going to go into real life here, but it's also tied to this motivation thing. So I always start the creation process of one of my podcast episodes by choosing a topic, outlining the major points that I want to make. And then as I was working on this podcast episode on how to get and stay motivated, as it happened, my daughter was in her room folding her laundry. And I thought that that might be kind of a funny anecdote for talking about getting motivated and staying motivated because, and I am quite sure that my daughter would agree here, folding laundry is one of those tasks that most of us don't feel particularly excited about. In fact, some of us might, like my daughter, even actively avoid it. And also, let's be real, I myself often end up in the camp of having two different piles of clothes on my bedroom floor, one that's clean and one that's dirty. My husband doesn't know which pile is which, only I know. And as the week goes on, the two piles like slowly change in shape, one growing bigger, one growing smaller. Sometimes they inch towards one another a little bit. And I'm laughing about this because it's really kind of a funny anecdote to use to talk about motivation. Because there's a lot of talk about how we can get motivated. And then once we're motivated, how do we stay motivated? And the reality is that there's a lot of things in life that we don't really feel motivated to do. I don't often feel motivated to fold my own laundry. Certainly my daughter doesn't either. My husband is another story. He's one of those weirdos. He folds it literally. He takes it straight out of the dryer and gets it done. Love you, babe. Love you, love you. Admire you. Not you. So we're getting into how to get and stay motivated today, and I'll be talking about that as it applies to the things we don't want to do, but also as it applies to what about those times where you know you want to do something, it would benefit your life, but for some reason you just don't feel motivated to do it. So I'm going to talk about motivation from a psychological perspective today, some of the data behind how motivation works. And I'm also going to share some of the research into how we get motivated and stay motivated, or I'm going to draw from that research and put it into an applied psychology perspective. But first, I wanted to talk about this topic from my personal experience, especially because here I am talking about how I don't feel motivated to do this thing, fold laundry, right? And yet, actually, most people in my life would describe me as a highly motivated person. And they're basing that on the outputs, the outcomes, right? I've written and published two books, The Courage Habit, 100% Fully Alive. I've run this business for well over a decade. It's required content creation, promotion, networking, showing up to be interviewed for other people's podcasts, in addition to creating content for, say, this podcast. I'm yapping all the time about CrossFit and running. I read prolifically. There are 15 different books on my office coffee table right now, and I'm legitimately reading all of them at the same time, which might be weird, but it works for me. Of course, I'm mentioning my husband. I'm mentioning that I'm a mom. That involves doing stuff as well. There's drop-offs. There's pickups. There's groceries. There's communicating about schedules. There's disagreeing about things and navigating disagreement. There's yard work, there's housework, there's all the things. So how is it possible that I can be so motivated in so many areas of my life, yet not very motivated around things like laundry? Well, let's talk about that and we can use it as an example. And I'm going to be speaking from an applied psychology perspective. I'm going to talk to you about what some of the research I've read says and how we might apply it to our lives. And then I'm going to end today's episode by giving you some really concrete ideas for how you can get and stay motivated with specific things that you want to be doing in your life. So when it comes to laundry, all right, I think a lot of it has to do with just not really caring whether my laundry is or isn't put away. And for the people like my husband, that sounds super weird. I do care about clean clothes, which is why I do my laundry. And yeah, when I'm getting after it and I'm folding my clothes immediately, even I would admit they are easier to find. But it also doesn't particularly bother me to sift through a pile of clean clothing to find what I need. I kind of just don't care. That's really what's going on. So that's one possible insight into why you might have trouble motivating yourself at your job or to eat more vegetables or to read some super smart book on, say, a political topic or some intellectual topic that you've always meant to learn more about. Maybe you intend to care, but maybe you don't really care so much. And that could be for a whole host of reasons. Maybe you don't really see the benefit. Maybe there's no particular cost to not doing it. But here's something that's kind of interesting, mentioning my husband. When I am most motivated to fold my laundry, I think everybody who's lived with someone probably knows what I'm talking about here. So I mentioned that my husband is much tidier and more organized than I am. And if he is having a bad day, he's just a little more irritable, I am more likely to fold my laundry. Why? Because if my husband's kind of already feeling annoyed and having a bad day, it's like I'm compensating for that by trying to relieve some of his stress. So there's a social reason, social meaning the people around me, the people in my environment, for why I might change my behavior. And I feel really lucky to be married to someone who pretty much takes things in stride. And when I leave laundry out most of the time, he doesn't get super pissed. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, he'd prefer if there was zero laundry at all times, ever, out anywhere. He'd prefer it's always put away. And I do try to be mindful of that. And particularly if I notice that he's stressed, behaving accordingly, because I love him. I want to try to accommodate the things that matter to him wherever I can. I want to try to help, you know, can't always fix or ease the stress that he's feeling in his life whenever something comes up, you know, maybe it's related to work or something else that he has on his mind, but I can fold the laundry. So, you know, so that's another insight into why someone might get motivated or stay motivated. Social pressure, social contagion, social influence, whether from one person or a group of people. If you care what someone thinks or what they desire, that might motivate you to do something. Certainly, my daughter, in folding her own laundry, it is completely and totally social pressure. It's mom and dad going, go fold your laundry. That's it. She's not motivated to do it on her own. So just with those two examples, we're touching on the concept of intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. And these concepts emerge from psychology, emerge from the work of Deci and Ryan, D-E-C-I and Ryan, R-Y-A-N. And this is coming back from the 1970s onward. And intrinsic motivation is when you're motivated to do something internally. It's a matter of your own personal drive and desire. If I was motivated to fold my laundry because I personally feel some sense of satisfaction around putting my clothes away, that would be intrinsic motivation. I think my husband is intrinsically motivated to fold his laundry. But in my daughter's case, where she's told by her parents, go fold your laundry, you can't get on the device until you go fold your laundry. You know, no, you got to go fold your laundry. You're not going to go do something else until that laundry's folded. That is extrinsic motivation. These words can be tongue twisters. That's motivation that comes from outside yourself. Okay. Also, if I notice that my husband is having a stressful day and I compensate by folding the laundry to try to ease his stress, that would also be extrinsic motivation. I'm not doing it just because I want to. I'm doing it because I'm noticing a sort of subtle, like, let's try to make life more easeful force coming from outside of myself. You can probably already figure out which of those two forces of motivation is more impactful in getting something done in the first place, in staying motivated long term. Intrinsic motivation is far better for motivation than extrinsic motivation. So if you're wondering, how do I get and stay motivated around the things that really, really matter to me, but I just can't seem to get going or stay going, look for the intrinsic motivation. And I will give you examples in today's episode of what that looks like, okay? Now, here's something I want to make sure that I touch base on. This is generally true for everyone. It is generally true that intrinsic motivation is a better motivator. It's more impactful. And I am seeing online more and more armchair pop psychology on social media with lists of things that are supposed traits that are linked to certain, let's say, conditions, spectrums, diagnoses. It's all over the place. I see this in particular with neurodiversity. So I've seen a lot of things posted on social media that say that one sign of autism, ADHD, neurodiversity is that you, if you are on that spectrum, you have less motivation to complete a task that doesn't interest you and more motivation to complete a task that does interest you. And I'm going to go into this briefly because this actually kind of applies to everyone, and I'd like to make sure that we're all kind of looking at the same thing in the same way. So far, and I'm open to being wrong, I'm not trying to be prosaic here. So far, I'm not seeing anything in the clinical literature that I'm searching on PubMed, which is a free resource to see peer-reviewed studies. There's a lot of abstracts that sometimes are behind a paywall, but you can also get to a lot of full research articles and see the methodology and the way that they went about the research. A lot of info in there. I completely nerd out on PubMed. It's run by the National Institutes of Health. So I've actually been trying to find something in the clinical literature that says, essentially, we've done this study and we have found that if you struggle to finish tasks you aren't interested in and have no problem finishing tasks that you are interested in, this is a trait specific to neurodiversity. I'm not seeing that. I will talk about what I have seen and why I think some people are making some connections in that direction in just a moment. I will also just say, speaking as someone who's not on the spectrum, who's worked with coaching clients, some of whom are on the spectrum, some of whom aren't, who are struggling with motivation. At least for me, I'd say that in my applied experience working with people on motivation, it's just generally true for everyone that if you don't really like doing something, you tend to be less motivated to do it. If you're not that interested, you tend to be less motivated. Just generally, I have found that that tends to be true, regardless of whether or not someone would identify as neurodiverse. And I bring this up because sometimes on social, I have heard people use the label of neurodiversity as the reason why they aren't motivated, and they take it to the extreme of, this is why I therefore can't succeed. And certainly, when someone goes to that extreme, they're not speaking for everyone who falls on those spectrums. Not everyone who is on a spectrum would agree with the idea that neurodiversity equals trouble staying motivated and therefore equals you cannot succeed at a goal. To me, that's a very extreme statement, and it's not one that's backed by research. So I'm not saying that that can't be someone's experience. I'm just saying that to me, that seems like an extreme statement based on what we know about how plastic the brain is, about how adaptable human psychology is. And so I'm going to get into a little bit about this question, which is, where are people getting this idea from then? That if you are neurodiverse, you will struggle with being motivated to work on things you aren't interested in, be more motivated to work on things you are interested in, and therefore you will always struggle in life because you struggle with focusing, finishing, and working on things you aren't interested in. Where's that coming from? I believe that it's probably coming from some clinical research showing that people who are neurodiverse, ADHD, autism, other diagnoses on that spectrum, they could have lower levels of dopamine overall. Now, just because clinical research shows that there could be a connection there with lower levels of dopamine overall, that doesn't mean it's that research is definitively saying, therefore, someone on the spectrum would be unable to focus or achieve their goals. Correlation is not causation. Just because there might be a connection between low dopamine and neurodiversity does not mean that one thing causes the other. And at least from what I understand about dopamine, and granted, I'm not a neuroscientist, my background is in psychology, not neuroscience. You know, I've read some things on neuroscience. That does not mean that I'm trying to say I'm an expert. But I would think from what I understand about low dopamine levels, that if someone's dopamine levels are lower, I would think that they would be lower just across the board. So if your dopamine levels are low and there's something in the biochemistry that keeps them low and therefore you struggle with motivation, I would think that that would mean that the struggle with motivation would be across the board, not just with things you don't like. I would think that if somebody has overall low levels of dopamine, chronically low dopamine, they would struggle even with being interested in the things that might interest, that formerly interested them, or the things that are novel, or the things that are new or more exciting. I don't know. I'd have to talk to a neuroscientist to confirm that, but that's at least what I'm understanding about dopamine, how it would seem that that would play out. Additionally, there are a few things to consider that even with that information about lower dopamine levels, neurotransmitters, no, dopamine is a neurotransmitter, they don't exist in a vacuum. There's not like this regular supply of the neurotransmitter dopamine that gets regularly released for me at exactly noon each day or something like that, or for you, for anybody else. Dopamine can actually be released in response to something in your visual field or as a response to certain behaviors. That's part of how we understand and study dopamine. We put people in controlled environments and we measure their dopamine levels, and then maybe you show them something or maybe you have them do something in a laboratory and you measure how dopamine reacts to what was seen in the visual field or what was the response to undertaking a certain behavior. So there could be behavioral aspects of someone's life, anyone's life, regardless of whether or not they're on a spectrum, that lower dopamine. So, you know, you could have a situation where someone has tried repeatedly to achieve something, they failed. It could be because they failed because they weren't setting themselves up for success. It could be that they failed due to factors totally outside of their control that prevented them from succeeding. And if they have had that experience over and over, they might then exhibit low dopamine levels. So I'm thinking, you know, their dopamine isn't going to rise with motivation for them to succeed in some way. I'm thinking of situations like maybe if somebody went through grade school really, really struggling. Maybe they were struggling because they went to bad schools. Maybe they were struggling because stuff was going on at home. Maybe they were struggling because they had a learning difference. If they were struggling and there was no progress, there was no resolution to those struggles where they could see at least some measure of success, over time there could be a connection there where there's, you know, just low dopamine all the time when it comes to anything school related, because there's a kind of learned helplessness that can kick in of like, why bother, right? Someone who's depressed can show lower dopamine levels. Someone consuming alcohol or THC might show lower dopamine levels. So I mentioned before, you know, dopamine levels can also increase in response to things in your environment. And this is where I think things get really interesting if you're going, I feel like I'm really low motivated. There are things you can do that will up your dopamine. So let's talk about that. One way that dopamine levels can be increased is by simply anticipating a possible reward. So trying to find something that you see as a reward and then going, okay, I'm just going to focus on that. This might be a reward. I'm looking forward to it. I'm anticipating it. Dopamine levels can rise. Physical exercise can increase dopamine levels. Engaging yourself in a task can raise your dopamine levels. So quite literally, you could be experiencing low dopamine and therefore low motivation to do something, but then force yourself to do the thing anyway, at which point there's a rise in dopamine. So there are things that you can do. And again, I'm going to get into some of the applied aspects of this. I think the point that I'm really trying to get at is that if you think you have low dopamine levels or some other biochemical reason for why you feel less motivated, which is showing up as low energy, feeling depressed, etc., first of all, check it out with a clinician. Actually make sure that that's what's going on. And second, the research shows that if you find some kind of reward to anticipate, if you engage in physical exercise, if you force yourself to do the thing you know you need to do, there is a corresponding raise in dopamine. And I don't know if this has been studied or not, but as I was preparing for this podcast episode, I started to get really curious to see if taking the things we do know about raising dopamine levels and turning those into a protocol of some kind could result in a sort of upward spiral of someone more, or like a flywheel, if you've ever seen that, where like once the motivation starts going, it just kind of can turn on its own to some degree. I'm wondering if there's some way of turning those behaviors into a protocol and studying whether or not that results in someone producing consistently higher dopamine levels. I don't know. I just think it would be an interesting study. So all of this having been said, I would ask that everyone listening here look into the research themselves. Like I said, it's free on PubMed. You can find peer-reviewed studies. You can talk to qualified support people and providers in your life. I am certainly staying in my lane here. I am not speaking on behalf of those who are neurodiverse. I'm just wanting to reassure everyone, and especially those who are neurodiverse as well as those who might struggle with motivation, you're not wired in one way. This isn't an inborn trait. It's not a situation where if you have some kind of biochemical or other reason where you're going to struggle or be challenged in this area, it's not a situation where it's like, that's it, you're done, you're always going to struggle. That's not what the clinical data says is the case. So now I'm going to shift directions a little bit, and I'm going to share with you some of the ways that I've found most helpful to get and stay motivated. And these are tools to me. Take them or leave them, of course, but these are the behaviors and mindsets that I adopt on a regular basis, especially if I'm in the weeds of something, I don't want to do it, I'm struggling, things like that. So first, and this is the biggest one for me, I am so big on my personal integrity as a source of intrinsic motivation. What I mean by that is that I know that if I want to be someone who has integrity, I have to practice integrity. Integrity is when your words and actions match and they are in alignment with your values, your beliefs, your commitments, your life vision. That definition is from my coach, Matthew Marzell. Wise person, helped me a lot in my life. And I don't like how I feel about myself when I know that I'm out of integrity. Therefore, I don't like how I feel about myself if I say to myself, I'm going to do something, exercise, meet a friend, write the content, create the podcast episode, whatever it is. I don't like how I feel about myself if I say to myself, I'm going to do something and then I don't do it. Therefore, I find it intrinsically motivating to finish what I start, to do what I said I would do. And note that I said, when I say to myself that I'm going to do something, I'm not talking about promises made to other people as a source of motivation. I'm talking about me, myself, and I. I don't like how I feel when I tell myself I'm going to do something and then I don't do it. I feel out of integrity with myself. I feel like I betrayed myself. And to avoid that feeling, 9 times out of 10, obviously I'm not perfect, but 9 times out of 10, if I say I'm going to do something, if I tell myself I'm going to do something, I will follow through. I don't like that feeling of being out of integrity, out of alignment with myself. Next thing, I work to be really, really conscious about what I say yes and no to in my life, thinking through the time it takes, the why for me, what I'll get out of it. And I tie that to motivation because if I was just saying yes to things without really thinking them through, then it's going to be harder to motivate myself to follow through. And I've observed that a lot of people who struggle with motivation struggle because they are yesed out. They are saying yes to everyone except themselves. And this is not just people pleasing. This is like type A overachievers. So for instance, someone who overworks at their corporate job, it is really hard to come home at the end of a long day of overworking and then say yes to exercise, yes to the time spent learning a new language. If someone is a chronic people pleaser who says yes when they really want to say no, they probably have some resentment built up, and therefore they're going to have a harder time saying yes to one more thing, even if that thing is a yes to themselves or something that would benefit them personally. In situations like that, where people are not as conscious about what they say yes and no to, saying yes to one more thing, even if it's something that would benefit you, probably feels like too much. Okay? So, practically speaking, here's what I mean when I say that I'm conscious about what I say yes and no to. So I'm going to give you an example that's tied to, say, like a goal. So if I sign up for a half marathon, I don't do that on a whim without thinking through the training time it's going to take. I don't do it just because in the moment it's like, oh, okay, seems like a fun idea. I sign up after looking at my calendar, considering the other things I have going on, asking myself why I want to do it, and then after all of that going, oh, okay. So if I were to put this race on my calendar X number of weeks out, I'd have this much to train. I'm going to buffer in a few weeks where I might have an off week or catch a cold, or I live in Colorado, maybe there's freezing ice on the ground and the terrain is not really great for getting a run in, maybe I got a lot of work deadlines. It's a conscious yes, a conscious no. I'm also not signing up for that half marathon to impress people. I'm doing it for me. I'm doing it to build my grit and resilience. There's that intrinsic motivation. I know from experience that when I push myself physically, I feel grittier and more resilient, and I like that feeling, and I notice the benefits in my life. I'm doing it because, believe it or not, I like running. I'm doing it for health reasons. There's all these intrinsic factors that are going into the decision to put that thing on my calendar. So the thing for you might not be the half marathon. Maybe you've always wanted to write a book. Maybe you want to spend more time with your children. Maybe you want to sign up for a class of some kind, but you're worried about the time it'll take. It's like, be conscious about that, about what you're saying yes and no to, because when it's actually time to put some action behind the yes, you know, the yes is the verbal, the yes is the okay, I'm going to do it, but then you got to actually walk your talk, you're going to feel more resistance and less motivation if you haven't really thought it through and gone, okay, this is what it actually means for me to do this thing with my life. And tied to that, I'll just say, what do I do about the things that are have-tos? The things like renewing your driver's license or taking your car in for a repair or pulling together tax receipts. What do you do about the things that you can't consciously say a yes or a no to? Well, here's my take on it. I think the why for tasks I don't particularly like doing is often, I'll feel so much better when this is done and I'm not thinking about getting it done anymore. And that ties in with the data that when we anticipate a reward of some kind, like the reward of being done with something that's annoying, then we're more motivated to do it. So I focus on that. Maybe that's why I don't fold my laundry. Like, it's not a have to. And I, you know, so, but generally speaking, because I'm just like you and I got to deal with those things like pulling together tax receipts or taking my car in for some reason in the middle of my day, those pain in the butt things, I just, whatever I can do to consciously choose to place my intentions and my attention on the thing I want, which is to be done, that's the reward, rather than what a pain in the ass it is to have to do the thing. And last, here's a novel idea on how to get and stay motivated. Who says that you have to be motivated? I mean, really consider that for a moment. Who says you have to be motivated? Who says you have to feel like it? Who says it's supposed to feel good to do something? And this is something that I'm seeing emerge more and more in our culture in recent years. People pushing the message, this is a lot of it on social, that if something doesn't feel right, step away. If things feel hard, drop them. And this idea that there's something quote unquote toxic about any mentality of pushing through, that if you subscribe to any mentality of pushing through, grit, discipline, hustling for something that matters to you, that you're somehow buying into this terrible belief system. Now, we're all in charge of our lives, right? Personally, I don't agree. The data on what builds our emotional resilience and our sense of determination also doesn't agree with that. If you want a really interesting kind of narrative slash aggregate of the data and how it applies specifically to how we talk about difficult issues, trigger warnings, all of that, fantastic book I would recommend is called The Coddling of the American Mind. Coddling, C-O-D-D-L-I-N-G. The Coddling of the American Mind. Might also surprise you, based on stereotypes, at least, the political parties that the writers are coming from, which they're pretty transparent about. The essential takeaway of the book, though, is that the way that we're currently handling discussion of challenging issues is not in alignment with what is best for us as individuals, for our society, in terms of building resilience, building better relationships, navigating conflict. And I would definitely say that resilience, better relationships, and navigating conflict are essential skills for each individual person and essential skills for a well-functioning society. So if you want to make yourself better, if you want to make society better, resilience, better relationships, and the ability to navigate conflict are pretty essential pieces of that. Instead of backing off from challenges as a way to preserve our self-esteem or avoid being triggered or preserve our sense of worth or to feel better about ourselves, we actually should be nudging into them. And there's data out there on this. And like I said, a lot of it is presented in The Coddling of the American Mind, fantastic book. So we should actually be nudging into these places that are challenging. We should be having the conversations that we don't feel like having. We should be trying to push ourselves to go beyond our current limitations. I mean, there's a bajillion quotes out there about how life is best lived beyond your comfort zone. That didn't come from nowhere. I will also say that I found in my personal experience that when I've pushed myself harder than I thought I could go or farther than I thought I could go or tried to do things that I initially did not think I could do, I have 100% always benefited. So, for instance, in my marriage, tough place to have to push through, I have had times where my husband and I struggled and I was frustrated and sad and therefore was really feeling like we were stuck, no way through, how do we navigate this impasse? But when I leaned in and kept looking and kept searching and would not give up, we found our way through. Now, because it's the internet, I need to also add that I am not saying that success is always that you stay in the marriage, that something is wrong with leaving a marriage, right? I'm not saying that. I'm saying that in my own marriage, when I pushed harder, when I leaned into the challenge before me, And it was a challenge that I really did think was beyond my capacity at that time. I personally benefited, as did the relationship. We found our way through. I've experienced that with my health as well. Some of you may know that more than 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. And I mean, I felt like shit, to put it plainly. and then I'd go to the doctors, and the doctors would tell me, not much I can do, but prescribe this medication that frankly really didn't seem like it was doing all that much. But there was something in me that just went, I just refused to throw up my hands and go, well, I guess that's it. No, I refused to do that. I leaned in, I read research, I tried 50 gazillion different things, and I finally did find my way to the state of health and energy that I have now, which is not perfect, right? Which what works for me might not work for you. I don't know. But I did find what worked for me at a time when medical experts with degrees were telling me, sorry, I don't know what to tell you. Multiple medical experts with far more knowledge and expertise and education in this area than I've ever had. They said there was no solution. Well, I found my way to solutions. Books I've written. It's a hard thing to write a book. A lot of people say they want to and then don't. And certainly, I have had plenty of creative projects abandoned over the course of my life. But of the books I have written, have succeeded in finishing, I've had days, I've had weeks where I sat down to write and had the worst case of writer's block ever and wondered how I ever wrote a fucking thing in my life. But I leaned into it. I refused to give up. I found my way. I'm even going to go out on a limb with this because I know someone's going to be going, but what about burnout? But what if, in fact, you push yourself so hard that you go into burnout? And since I am pretty transparent about the fact that I have gone into burnout before with overwork, I actually feel like that experience was of benefit to me. I know, right? Weird. But here's why. It showed me where my limits actually were. I learned different ways of working that were more efficient and more supportive of me, of my life. I don't look at the situation of times when I've gone into burnout and go, I'm a victim of a society that expects people to work harder than they should. I go, I'm kind of curious about the challenge of working on the things that matter to me to my limits. I'm kind of curious about how far I can go. And this is something somewhat of an unconventional take. I talk about it in my book on burnout, which is, the title is 100% Fully Alive. I don't want to live a minimalist life. I like living a very full life where I'm constantly challenging myself, where I'm doing things with my husband and daughter, and I'm writing and I'm working and I'm CrossFitting and I'm studying Italian and I'm planning travel adventures and I'm training for distance races. That's what I want for my life. I don't want to pare it down and have a schedule full of white space. And yes, I have examined the question, is this like a reactive thing? Is there something unhealed in me that's compelled to like put things on the calendar that don't really matter to me just so I don't have like free space in my head or something? No, that's not what's going on. I've examined that question. I've examined it with professionals. That's not what's going on. 100% fully alive life to me is one where I'm traveling and I'm studying and I'm learning and I'm working and I'm pushing my limits. I like that. And what I talk about in 100% Fully Alive is that I found it is possible actually to have this really full life, to do more, if you set up your foundational habits to support it. So 100%, if you've got a lot of stuff going on in your life and you don't have the foundational habits in place, burnout will come a-calling. But if you set up the foundational habits, you're capable of so much more. So for instance, I'm going to go with something super banal, but it's part of my life. Part of my motivation to eat well, to eat the salads, is knowing that if I don't eat well, my energy levels will drop. And then I'm not able to do the things that I, you know, just listed off. So 100% potato chips taste better than salads. Tacos, I'm about it, okay? But if all I'm eating is potato chips and tacos and pizza and da da da, like my energy levels will drop and then I'm not able to do the things I just listed off. So in that way, salads, vegetables, whatever, they aren't even really a bummer for me to eat anymore. They're the micronutrient elixir that's going to make me feel like a more capable badass. Eating well is a foundational habit that allows me to do the other things I want to do. And it's kind of nice because then there's this nice cycle of motivation. I'm motivated to eat the salads because it allows me to do things I want to do. As I can do more of the things I want to do, the next time salads are on the table, I'm all the more motivated to eat the salad. So all of that having been said, you don't have to feel like doing something. You don't have to want to. Sometimes in life, you just do it. You just do the hard thing and it's okay. And I actually think I want to touch on one more point on motivation that I'll make today. It's kind of tied to the last one. Maybe it's its own separate thing. I don't know. You'll decide. I think we need to keep hard in context. We need to keep hard, or what we define as hard, in context. When we don't feel motivated to do something, it's usually because that thing feels hard. And what I recognize and would invite you to recognize as well is that things often feel hard at the beginning or if we aren't consistent. That's the context. Because if you try anything enough times, if you practice, if you make it a habit, it won't feel so hard. So yeah, it feels hard to get up early in the morning at first, and if I don't do it often. It feels hard to run at first, and if I don't do it often. It feels hard to deal with difficult coworkers at first, and if I don't practice patience or watch my judgments of them on a regular basis. It feels hard to notice your negative thoughts and reframe them at first, and if you don't do it often. So putting hard in context means that when my motivation is low to start a new habit or routine, I recognize that it's probably only feeling so hard because I'm just starting. I'm not used to it yet. When I'm doing it regularly, when I'm used to it, when I've created something as a habit, it's not so hard. Humans are incredibly resilient and adaptable. We might struggle to change behavior initially, but we can change it. And when we do, and when we get comfortable with that change behavior, that's when it becomes the new normal. And that's when you don't even have to rely on, how do I get motivated? How do I stay motivated? It's like, no, this is just what I do. This is when I get up. This is how I handle conflict. This is when I exercise. This is what I eat. This is just how I do things. That becomes your new normal. So that's what I have for you today. And these are the takeaways. So first, there's nothing about how you're wired that will prevent you from getting and staying motivated. And you can take specific behaviors if you need to work with your biochemistry to produce more dopamine, which can help with motivation. Intrinsic motivation, going to get you farther than extrinsic motivation. God, that is a hard word to say. And if you can tie anything you have to do, quote unquote have to do, with something that is intrinsically valuable to you, such as I do with this example of using my commitment to integrity and being someone who practices integrity, you can find more intrinsic motivation. Okay. So then there's also, how do you be conscious about what you say yes and no to? Because if you are conscious about what you say yes to, then you can avoid getting yourself into a situation where you've agreed to something or told yourself you're going to do something without really thinking it through, which kind of sets you up to be less motivated and therefore less, it's going to be harder to actually follow through. And whenever you are looking at those have-tos, try to focus on the thing that is the reward. If nothing else, I'll feel so much better when this is done and I'm not thinking about getting it done anymore. That could be your reward. This novel idea, who says you have to be motivated? Who says you have to feel like it? Who says it has to feel good? And what if doing things you don't feel like doing actually gives you some of that gritty resilience and motivation? What if doing that thing shows you your capacity? And then we've got this last idea that I've started to talk about, which is, how do we keep hard in the context of what hard really is? Because there are a lot of things that we might struggle to get and stay motivated around because we've decided that it's hard, and we're not remembering that actually, with practice, it's probably not going to be as hard. When it's not so new, when you're more consistent, it stops feeling so hard. All right, so I hope that this was helpful to you today. My biggest hope is really that you are fired up and kind of looking around at your life and going, you know what? I could be doing some really cool stuff. I'm kind of a badass. I'm excited about this. I'm excited about that, all that. So I hope that this is something that you rock out to. Please hop on over to Instagram. Let me know like how you're doing with this kind of stuff. Comment on a post or something like that. And here's to you getting and staying motivated for all the things that you want to do with your life, your one precious, incredible life. And of course, remember that if you want additional support with anything that you're trying to do, the book 100% Fully Alive can give you some great strategies for how to be motivated, how to manage your time, and how to do that and live that very 100% fully alive life without tipping over into burnout. All right, that's today's episode of the Your Courageous Life podcast. Thank you for listening. To dive in deeper and continue the work, head on over to yourcourageouslife.com. See you there.